from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum this morning, what does it mean to be human and how do we want to live? Those are two big questions that form the backbone of On Being, the award-winning public radio show hosted by Peabody Award-winning broadcaster Krista Tippett. The show delves into questions of meaning and faith with devout believers and atheists alike, including poets, actors, musicians, scientists, and theologians. And in her new book, Becoming Wise, Krista Tippett reflects on the lessons she has learned from her guests about family, civility, and how to be more fully present in our lives. That's up ahead after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program, the second hour of the program. We welcome Peabody Award-winning broadcaster and National Humanities Medal recipient Krista Tippett to this Forum Hour. The New York Times bestselling author recently published a book called Becoming Wise, an inquiry into the mystery and art of living. She's the host of NPR's On Being, and we welcome her to the second hour of Forum. Glad to have you with us, Krista.
I'm so glad to be with you.
I guess I'd like to begin by talking about wisdom with you. We did actually put out a question to our listeners through social media on Facebook, and particularly, who's the wisest person you know and why? And maybe we'll get to that question with you, and we welcome listeners actually weighing in on this. But I always thought On Being makes me think of ontology, and ontology does make me think of wisdom. You've done a lot of listening. Let's crystallize what you've learned in terms of what wisdom is or what it isn't.
Well, I think what it isn't is a property of saints, or, you know, there's a language of Einstein that I was following around for a lot of years. He said that he looked at somebody like Gandhi or Moses or Jesus or Buddha or St. Francis of Assisi, and he said these are spiritual geniuses and that they are as necessary to the dignity, security, and joy of humanity as the discoverers of objective knowledge. And there's something to that, but I think what I've learned in my life of conversation, what I find so fascinating is that I think wisdom is accessible to all of us. It emerges through the raw materials of our lives, and even, in fact, if you look at the spiritual geniuses who come most immediately to mind, or if you look at people who were saints, they also had very real, messy human lives, and wisdom doesn't emerge in spite of difficulties. It emerges through that.
This comes to...
But I think it's something we have to work for.
It just comes to kind of a definition that I was able to glean from your book. Who we are to each other is really... And you're talking about maybe even in the most mundane sense who we are, or the most ordinary, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's the great ancient question behind philosophy and religion. What does it mean to be human? And I think wisdom in our spiritual traditions has emerged through also exploring who we are to each other. And it's so interesting that in this 21st century where we are literally connected, you know, our well-being is and our survival, as well as our flourishing, are literally dependent on other people, on far-flung strangers. That question of what it means to be human and who we are to each other, these questions become inextricable and they become a matter of very, very practical import.
Also talk about it as joining the inner life with the outer life and doing that through the, well, process of trial and error, the mistakes we make, as well as what we learn from those mistakes, yeah?
Yeah, I think that joining inner life with outer presence in the world for me has become the litmus test of spirituality when it's interesting. I think that, you know, spirituality kind of has a wrap of private endeavor, purely private endeavor. But what I see in, you know, radiant lives, people who are really making an imprint on the world they can see and touch. And I also see this as a real longing, I think, among the young, emerging generations. They, you know, people who grew up in the 1980s, 1990s, many of whom don't affiliate with religious identity the way their parents or grandparents did, you know, they grew up in a moment of incredibly toxic, strident religious voices in American public life. And I think that this language that they're bringing into our vocabulary of integrity and authenticity and transparency is a way of insisting that we join our deepest values, our deepest aspirations, you know, who we want to be with how we live.
You know, you've been talking about these subjects on the radio, going with the program people might recognize was called Speaking of Faith. And I think we actually spoke about my book, Spiritual Envy, which is a book all about that quest that you're talking about,
yeah.
Particularly pervasive among young people. I was talking about this with producers here about how things seem to cluster. We're talking about you. We've talked about other matters of faith. Just over the course of this last week, we had Susan Jacoby on, who talked about conversions. You found that there really is a kind of mother load for this, these topics of discussion, that people really want to talk about a spiritual quest. They want to talk about faith, and they want to talk about an attempt to try to find how to fill the emptiness that they may feel within.
Yes, yeah, of course they do. And I think, you know, what we get to do, what we have to do also is open up our imagination and vocabulary about, you know, what it means to talk about spiritual life. And I do think that, especially in the late 20th century, we tried to kind of compartmentalize these things. You know, your religion was something you did on Sunday morning or Friday night. We kind of bracketed out. We tried to create values, neutral spaces. This was all nobly motivated. We wanted to create hospitable spaces for diversity. But we kind of, you know, we bracketed out some of the most important parts of ourselves. Again, I think if we think about spiritual life, which may or may not have a religious affiliation, may or may not have a transcendent component, but if we think about that as our desire and our effort to combine, to join our inner life with our outer presence in the world, this is very practical stuff, right? This is how we show up as professional people, as colleagues in workplaces, as family members, as neighbors, and how we, and choosing to do that, insisting on a kind of meaning and depth and a content to that. I like to use the language of virtues. These are kind of very practical pieces of conduct that I think describe a life that is worthy, and that is pleasing, and that is good for us and good for the people around us.
When you use a word like spiritual, or for that matter, transcendent, though, a lot of people, even people who don't get nervous when they hear the word religious, do get nervous because they don't necessarily understand what it means, or it doesn't necessarily speak to their internal life. I mean, you can talk about sunsets and love of children and art and all of the kinds of things that people do talk about when they're looking for something of higher meaning or that will elevate their spirits, that we tie to the notion of spirituality. But there are many people who just come up with, it doesn't speak to me. It doesn't resonate for me.
The word spiritual?
Yeah, or for that matter, what we're talking about, which is a kind of higher level of transcendence or, you know.
I don't know. Let me break out some of the questions I think of. You know, this is a part of us where we ask, what does it mean to be human? You know, how to love? And I don't just mean, I don't mean that in a fluffy way. I will say, Michael, that I've probably been less comfortable with the language of spirituality myself in my life than I have been with the language of religion, because I think it, you know, it has this heft to it, you know, theology. But you know, what does it mean to be human? What makes for a good life? What makes for a good death? Who are we to each other? I don't think there's anything. I think these are very essential questions, and the way we are grappling with them, if we are holding them actively, they do penetrate our interactions, you know, in our lives, in every sphere of our lives.
Why do we feel, many of us, uncomfortable with a good death? the idea of death being somehow beneficent or virtuous or I don't know what.
Well, here's something else I'd say. To me, working with these questions it's so reality based, right? It's so reality based, and the thing is that American culture, in large parts, has not been very reality based, and our kind of this illusion that we've lived with that death will not come, you know, that if we're not denying a mortality outright, we're in denial about it. And even how in our medical care and in the medical system for some time, you know, death is considered a failure. And there was a long time until just in recent decades that hospice came along, you know, that essentially, you know, death was a failure and care ran out because we had so stopped attending to this as a reality, this as an inevitability. Yeah. So again, to talk about this part of life that we call religious or spiritual is where we actually face these things head on and not only face them and take them seriously, but see that even and sometimes especially in these moments of frailty in human life, in moments of loss, even in these moments we grow and we are learning more about that question of what it means to be human, why we're here.
Talking with Krista Tippett, who is the author of On Being. She's also the author of a number of other books, Einstein's God and Speaking of Faith. And she'll be speaking at the JCC in San Francisco on the 19th of April at 7 o'clock. We're going to open up our phone lines, get your responses. I want to talk with you about love, though. So we can't talk about death without talking about love, or love without talking about death, it seems to me. We have Woody Allen to thank for that in part. Love you talk about as a muscular practice. What do you mean by that?
Yes, I love a lot of the words we need most. A lot of the words, in fact, around this part of life, peace, justice, compassion, forgiveness, they get kind of, you know, they've been on Hallmark cards, they've been on bumper stickers, they're overused, they're watered down, and love is the most watered down. I mean, love is, you know, the thing that we talk about it as something that you fall into, you fall out of. The English language is especially kind of impoverished. You know, the word itself presents a problem. In other languages, in Greek, you have philia, the love of friendship. You have eros, which is probably what we were talking about, romantic love, about 99% of the time in American culture. You also have agape, which is practical care for strangers or neighbors. You know, you have metta in the Buddhist Pali tongue, which is about kind of a benevolent care for others, and also a psychological acuity that compassion and care also that you have to extend that to yourself. So we have this one word in which we fold all of these different kinds of love. And you know, one of the things I've been thinking about so much in my conversations in the last few years with the place we're at, with these chasms in American life of racial well-being, economic well-being. I'm intensely aware that we have actually decided to hold the question of hate in our public life. We've created a legal category for this opposite of love, this place human beings can go when tolerance wears out and the worst of which we are capable rushes in. And I'm also aware that people across history, certainly Martin Luther King Jr., you know, they didn't just call for reforms and new laws. They called for humanity to love. You know, the vision of the civil rights movement was first and foremost to create the beloved community. That is unfinished business. That is woefully unfinished business. And so the minute I start to talk about speaking of love, kind of holding the question of love as a public good, I'm very aware that we have to figure out what that means. We have to figure out what it means to embody that. And it can't be romantic. It can't be just a matter of feeling, which actually in our private lives, our loves are complex. And we know that sometimes it's just a matter of how you are, what you do. It's a way of being. And I think that our challenges are so vast and they have this deep human dimension that we need to figure out what love would be as something robust and muscular and in public.
And when you talk about hate, I'm struck by the fact that you think that what we're facing now with respect to radical Islam may be a crisis within Islam as opposed to the two civilizations argument. And I'm struck by that because, remember, after 9/11, there were all these headlines as, why do they hate us? And they do seem to hate us. That is, many in the particularly jihadist movement.
Yes, there's a... And there's a long, long history. There's a seedbed for that. But if you look at the catharsis, the crisis, the wars, the acts of terrorism that happen every day across the world, it is largely, vastly Muslims who are dying on the front lines of that crisis. That doesn't deny the fact that, you know, bombs go off in Brussels or Paris.
Or San Bernardino.
But that is at the sidelines of what this is, which is essentially just a huge existential crisis within Islam. And the Muslims I have spoken with across these years who are working on those front lines understand that this is work that will not be finished in their lifetime. This is you know, kind of a cosmic global crisis. Christianity, Islam is 600 years younger than Christianity, and 600 years ago, Christians were waging global holy wars and burning heretics at the stake. But we inhabit a globalized world, and the terrorists. I hate Islam. I wouldn't like the language of Islamists. But, you know, the terrorists, the holy warriors of today have airplanes and global weaponry. You know, global means of communication. And so in a very real sense, Islam's internal crisis is all of our crisis. And that is a very complex thing to take on.
Is it as complex or perhaps comparable in some ways to the kind of, well, emptiness and pain that many Americans feel that draw them into, let's say, you know, supporting a candidate like Donald Trump, or the kind of fighting that goes on back and forth in our political world?
I would say, obviously, this is a loaded kind of area to walk into, but what I would say, that what I attend to when I'm looking at global terrorism, or when I'm looking at some of the most discouraging, you know, political gatherings right now in this country that actually become violent in places, the common denominator I see is a huge amount of raw human pain and fear. And, human fear, when it shows itself in public, most often comes out looking like anger. But when we only address it as anger, or address the violence of it, we don't have good ways, good vocabularies. We don't have a patience about actually taking that pain and that fear seriously and addressing it head on. And so we see a lot of dynamics which just replicate themselves over and over again, you know, different circumstances, but the same human dynamic. And I argue in the book that we have to start grappling with that directly if we are going to advance. This idea, you know, that he who does not know history is doomed to repeat it is actually not true, because history gets repeated all the time. And there's something strange about the 21st century that we have, you know, the most sophisticated technology, we have a globalized world, and somehow that is it's forcing us to see the raw human the combustible raw, you know, human dynamics are what has suddenly just reemerged on the surface. And until we address that in manifold ways, we are just going to be in this cycle we've been in.
No, you say our radar century. Is broken. I mean,
the radar is broken. Yeah,
the way maybe to fix the radar are those traditional virtues of hope and love and civility and service and the kinds of things that you do emphasize. I'm wondering, yeah. though. I'm kind of wondering. I want to ask you about where hope fits in. You know, what Emily Dickinson said, that thing with feathers that perches in the soul, if indeed there is a soul. I read a lot of what you write as being filled with hope. It may go back to your, you know, Southern Baptist roots and your belief in a spiritual renewal movement and so forth. But what gives you hope?
Well, you know, and I want to acknowledge that when you start talking, when you bring hope into this discussion, or you talk about hope as something with feathers, it can sound really abstract and it can sound fluffy and it can sound like something that could not be muscular enough to be an antidote to what is going wrong. And I'm very much about a reality base, and that's why I don't actually use the term optimism, because I think optimism is kind of about wishful thinking. And for me, you know, hope is reality based. It works with reality. It takes in what is wrong and what is broken and what is dark. But it is also a choice, and it is a choice to see the fuller picture, not only the good that is emerging. That, again, as you said, you know, the radar is broken. So the radar tells us about everything that is catastrophic. We have very sophisticated ways of deeply analyzing what is broken and what is evil. We don't apply nearly so, and I mean journalism as well as our other kind of cultural ways of analysis. We don't apply nearly as sophisticated a lens to looking at goodness as something that is real. I mean, it is there. It's there on every side of those same stories, but it is below the radar. I guess you could say that what I've been doing for the last 15 years is drawing out this kind of nuanced, sophisticated goodness in all kinds of lives, modern lives, and finding that to be very real and to be having very real ripple effects. That we have to start finding ways to tell that story. And we also have to actually, there's a discipline of looking for those stories, because they don't rise to the surface of what passes as news.
Well, you've got a lot of them in your book. And of course, what comes to mind, not, I hope, cynically, but, you know, the road to hell paved with good intentions and all that, establishing what is goodness sometimes, just like establishing what is human, becomes a monumental type of question that dwarfs almost our imaginations. But you give it a good shot, and I'm going to actually I'm going to invite our listeners to give it their best shot. Actually, two questions that really resound for me here that I'd like to put forward and get listener responses to. We're having a wide-ranging and I think rather important discussion with Krista Tippett, who has given much thought and much effort to talking about this, even working at St. John's Abbey in Minnesota, interviewing people all over, and some of the more extraordinary people. I think about Minnesota, I think about Garrison Keillor. I got to get that out of my mind here. It's a whole different kind of religious, spiritual
dimension. It's a different kettle of fish, as they say.
But let's find out from our listeners. I mean, what does it mean to be human is a question that, you know, the greatest philosophers have grappled with. What does it mean to you? But even in a more reality-based, to use Krista's language here, question, who is wise and why? We've put that out to you as well. Let me invite you to join us now. You can do that by calling us, and we welcome your calls. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Feel free to call and join the conversation. 866-733-6786, or email us forum@kqed.org, or go to our website kqed.org/forum and click on this segment. You can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Krista Tippett, and she asks questions, very serious and profound questions, like what does it mean to be human and how do we want to live? And those are the two questions that actually form the backbone of On Being, the award-winning public radio show which she hosts. And in her new book, Becoming Wise, she reflects on the lessons she's learned from her guests about family, civility, and how to be fully more present in our lives. She'll be speaking at the JCC in San Francisco on April 19th. You are welcome to join the program either by phoning us at our toll-free number 866-733-6786, or emailing us forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is at @KQEDForum. Get into a lot of semantic traps when we use even the word spiritual or talk about whether humanity ought to include in terms of on being a spiritual dimension. Carol writes, the word spiritual means so many things to so many people that it guarantees misunderstanding. It should be used sparingly, like profanity, in the hope of improving honest understanding. Krista, what do you think? Profanity is an analogy?
I totally agree. I agree. And I think that when we use a word like spiritual, we have to kind of surround it with an ecosystem of other words and especially with practices. We kind of have to show what we're talking about. We have to fill it out. We can't assume that a word like that has any of the same connotations in the mind of the person we're speaking to that it does for us.
Well, you raise another word that has always intrigued me in your book and that I'd like to go to, and maybe we'll get some listener comment on this as well. And that's the word mystery, which is a literature mm-hmm. professor I associate more with Flannery O'Connor probably than who's a religious Catholic. But it goes back to the ancients, of course. It goes back to time immemorial. The idea of the mystery in our lives and how to, I'll use this word advisedly, divine it. But you go to some degree to talk about how religious people can learn, scientists can learn more, or the religious people can sort of translate for scientists what mystery means, even though scientists who are antithetical to religion.
Yeah, no group. I interview quite a few scientists and they absolutely, as a group, use the word mystery more often, more with great passion. I think scientists are not just comfortable with what they don't know, but excited by what they don't know. Einstein used the word mystery a great deal, and he said that a reverence for mystery and a capacity for wonder is at the best of science and religion and the arts. I think mystery is actually at the orthodox core of our religious traditions, and that it's something that, you know, if our traditions took that more seriously, I think it could leaven. It could leaven their certainties in the world. But I think of mystery as a common human experience. It's mysterious to be born. It's mysterious to fall in love. You know, death is this great mystery. Again, you know, many of those scientists I'm speaking with, they don't imbue that word mystery with transcendence, but it is. It is beyond what we can fathom with our five senses, with our experiences, and somehow it elevates. It has a capacity to elevate and ennoble us as human beings,
or what we can fathom with all our technology. I was just thinking, you know, about
or that absolutely, absolutely.
All
in fact, I think
interstellar
that,
space that's so mysterious to us that we know nothing about.
Yeah, yeah. So it's thrilling. Actually, and I think that if there's one effect of all my conversations, these years of conversations on me, it is to be thrilled by mystery, to take delight in it.
Well, I'm going to go to our callers. A quick question, though, from Bill, who asks, other than what is believed, is there really any difference between faith and superstition?
Yes.
you got to make a leap with one, right?
Yeah. Well, I would just say that question is answered life by life. So it's like saying, I mean, I can't talk about faith. Faith is evolutionary. You know, faith is not only different. You know, faith works itself out life by life. It is evolutionary in any life. I think the question is too broad. I'm sure that there are places where faith is absolutely the same as superstition. But I absolutely would say that it would be wrong and false and demeaning for many, many billions of people around the world to say that the two are always the same thing.
Let me bring our callers in, and we begin with you, Scott. You're welcome to the program. Good morning.
Hey, thank you. Good morning. I love this quote by W.H. Auden, I think it is, and it says, "We are lived by forces we pretend to understand." And for me, there's the mystery. And what I mean specifically is the relationship between our conscious psyche or our conscious awareness and our unconscious side. It's almost as if we sit on the on the very tip of a wave, and below us is this great mystery of unconscious forces that govern the way we live our lives, govern what we say, how we say it. And there's also these physiological systems that we sit on top of that we have no idea how they run our moods and our temperaments and whatnot. So for me, that's exciting because, you know, we've used science to explore the outside world for a long, long time. And I think that we have technology that's coming up that will allow us to observe consciously the unconscious side of ourselves. And what I mean by that is like just using technology to feed back to us, like our behaviors throughout the day, what tone of voice we use, what are our word selections, and assimilate it and piece it together in a meaningful pattern so that we can understand it consciously. But in the end, I think we're governed by these vast unconscious forces that we really have no idea what they are, how they work. And that's what I think people call God myself. So anyways, just wanted to share that.
Yeah, I'm glad you did, Scott, and I thank you for that. I've been thinking also, sort of dovetailing off Scott's call here, Krista, a lot lately about luck. I mean, it plays a major role in our lives, whether we realize it or not, in ways. I mean, we call it good fortune, call it dumb luck, call it lady luck, you know, whatever you want. But in ways that we, I think, usually don't even understand or recognize. We go in streaks. You know, that's luck.
And the physicists would call that randomness, I think.
They would. They would call it Heisenberg or something. Yeah. Well, let me get another caller on here. Let's go to Elliot in Oakland. Elliot, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah. Hi. I really echo a lot of what the previous caller just said. As a psychoanalytic psychotherapist and a director of a nonprofit that teaches beatmaking as a mental health and educational intervention, I also think that art is, and consciousness are fundamentally human. And the capacity to reflect and also the lack of capacity to reflect and be aware of the unconscious factors that the previous caller was talking about. And I think also to be human is to have to encounter the fact that there are a lot of ugly parts of being human, and there are beautiful parts of being human. We have to, I think a wise person, speaking of wisdom, has the capacity to encounter and take on, you know, the challenges of encountering the ugly parts of oneself and what it means to be greedy, what it means to have rage, what it means to be resentful, encounter that, be aware of it, and accept it, kind of come to, you know, what Ogden or other folks would call like a depressive position, where you encounter reality, you accept it. You can't always be accepting reality. We have to escape to our fantasies. But I think that that's super important, and I think art, to me, really speaks to something that is fundamentally human, and that's why, just a plug to my nonprofit, we teach underserved youth and all sorts of underserved communities around the Bay Area, around the world, through art and through music and the universal culture of hip-hop as a way to connect across cultures, et cetera. So I think that that's fundamentally human.
Well, that's well said, Elliot, and I thank you for that. And some thoughts from you, Krista?
Well, I love these last two calls. The frontiers we are on now in science, as much as anywhere else, of understanding ourselves, of understanding our brains, of unlocking creativity and consciousness, and understanding our unconscious. You know, these are the things that give me hope that actually in this generation we can start to become wiser and not just smarter as a species. And, you know, for me, this has very, very practical application, right? So, for example, we're all aware of the unfinished business of the racial life we want to have together, of the world we want to be living in, but what we know now that was not known 50 years ago in the civil rights movement is, you know, W.E.B. Du Bois said the problem of the 20th century is the color line. What we know now is that as much as we can erected laws and systems and structures to dictate against that, there is a color line in our head. But we now have this knowledge. You know, there's this science of implicit bias. And that knowledge is a form of power we have scientific and spiritual technologies for pinning those aspirations to action. And it has everything to do with, yes, facing the darkness in ourselves, facing the worst possibilities of humanity, but also very practically kind of in our daily conduct and also holding each other to this, rising to this better self, moving beyond mere consciousness to wisdom.
It's a kind of evolutionary view that you have, and I'm sympathetic to it.
It's an evolutionary view. Yeah.
But what do you do with the fact that people will often say they'll do dreadful things, they'll do unspeakable things, and they'll say, "Well, I'm only human." I mean, in other words,
within the grand scheme,
it seems to be these are mistakes that you proclivities that you have, and that's what meaning being human is.
Yeah, it is, and becoming, the becoming word is just as important as the wise word. And in the thinking I've been doing, it's not perfection. It's not a destination. It's not something that's ever finished. And I think we sometimes tell ourselves, you know, we're aware of.
Wait, excuse me. Why don't you call your show On Becoming rather than On Being?
On Becoming. Well, I might have to change it after this. But I think it can be a way we let ourselves out of aspiring to be wise, of aspiring to more completely match our inner aspirations with our outer lives by saying, well, I'm not perfect. You know, I keep making the mistake. And that's true. But actually, you know, the science of neuroplasticity that we have now, the understanding that we have that actually our brains and even like with genetic effect, with our behavior, we can change our bodies, we can change our brains. So becoming more virtuous, becoming more patient, becoming more loving, these are a matter of practice. Just like anything else we do, like playing the piano or throwing a ball, and that's how we get better at it.
Well, let me read a comment from sort of a question and comment from Anne, who writes, I dislike the emphasis on love to cure the world's ills. It implies somehow that those who are suffering need to add the struggle to love on top of their efforts to seek justice, safety, and health. What is the problem with the old Madisonian ideal that we humans can exercise our humanness by creating laws that best address justice, fairness, etc.? Do we really need to love? Why?
Well, you know, one thing I would say is I'm not talking about love as this emotion that you feel. I'm talking about love as something very practical. I wish we could address, I wish we could create perfect justice with laws, but I don't see that there is any proof of that. Again, to come back to our racial present, we enacted laws. But it is the human heart and it is human behavior that thwarts that again and again, or that distorts the very laws that were enacted to address that injustice. What I hear and have learned from wise people and also scholars who study how meaningful social change happens is that new realities are created by a quality of relationship between unlikely human beings, and that kind of relationship and that kind of human level change has to precede the big movements that we see that overturn structures, and it needs to follow them if we have not merely overturned structures but are also creating a new reality.
We're talking to Krista Tippett, and her radio show on NPR is called On Being. She's also the author of a new book. And the book is also called, it's actually called Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. And I'm going to go to more comments here, and let me just read a couple more before I go to more calls. Lena writes, children are wise. I was struck by an installation made by kindergartners at my daughter's school that asked students to think about ideal communities. One of the quotes read, we share. And I thought to myself in passing, if only adults in the world would follow this really simple ethos, we'd all be okay. Another listener writes, I find that if life is seen as a continuity that is carried through generations, there is purpose and a place for the young and old. Youth is a period of self-exploration, and if fully experienced, allows all that flows in to flow out as elders, thinking that your life is part of a bigger picture. You don't need religion to justify value. Let me go to more of your calls, and we'll go next to David. David, welcome.
Yes, good morning. I'm very much like Chris in my beginning. I was a Southern Baptist, and I'm now an atheist. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I would really love to address this terminology, wisdom, which is very much akin to spirituality. It has way too many meanings. And let me explain this. Without clarity, you can forget about wisdom. And by that, here's what I mean. I hear both of you talking in opposing dualistic terms. Good, bad, evil, right, wrong, so on, religious, non-religious, all these terms are predicated on judgmental essence, if you want to call it an essence, but it's all judgmental type thinking. Now, that's your wisdom. Now, here's my clarity. Those are non-existent because they're judgmental. And because they're non-existent, I only deal with what is. And by that, I mean everybody has their judgment on what happens in front of it. And that is a personal judgment, and that's what is. So
forgive me, David, that you're saying everything is subjective. Isn't that what we call solipsism? Everybody has it.
Michael, I missed that last part because...
You're saying everything is subjective. That's what we call solipsism. That means that the only truth comes through the self.
The only truth... No, I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is that I'm a non-linear being, and unfortunately, being in a human form, a lot of folks think linearly because that's our best form of perception. Therefore, we have all kinds of illusions going on in front of us. You use the word evil. Here's an interesting concept. How about the Aramaic term used by Jesus for the word evil, which means unripened, for instance? See, that's clarity.
Okay, I thank you for the call. Write this as all, as Lear said. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think what I want to say is that the litmus test for me is not what we think, and I'd like to, you know, judgmental is not a word I think people apply to me who know my work, and it's not a quality I admire. I'm interested in not so much, I'm not interested in linear categories, but I am interested as the litmus test in the quality of the effect we have on others and the world around us. And, you know, synonyms for me for wisdom wise would be generative, resilient, humane, winsome. These are ways of being and not of thinking, although thinking may be involved. They're certainly not ways of judging.
But he mentioned the word duality, and I'm struck by the fact that the Western thinking largely is linear, as you can well imagine, as most people know. You go into Hinduism and Buddhism, and there's much more circular kind of thinking, especially when it comes to, I'll use a fancy word here, eschatology. That is, you know, how we exist and how humanity moves along a certain trajectory. So,
yeah, and I think what a theological insight says is that in each of us, all of those capacities exist, right? None of us is one or the other. It's how do you navigate that, and what do you choose to practice and to develop?
I got a couple of emails here I want to read. John says, medical science is extending age. Some say the first person to be immortal is already alive today. Think how it would change faith and our outlook on life. There's one we'll have to grapple with in a whole hour's time. But let me read another comment by Dean, who writes, they're doing it at Google. They think they're doing it with Ray Kurzweil and company. Dean writes, I once heard a great definition for God. Man is God yet realized fully, and God is man yet manifested totally. For me, this is the reality of what it means to be human, and the goal of each life is to connect with their inner being, which is God. Okay, more calls. Let me go next to Cadden. Morning.
Hi, yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to make a comment with regards to the word mystery that's been used a lot. Isn't it fundamentally different, at least in practice, used in the scientific world as opposed to the religious and or spiritual, but I'm just focusing on religion here, and that is, I mean, mystery within science is at the heart of it. It's fantastic. It's, you know, trying to understand the world and come up with some testable ways to prove all of these mysteries. And coming from a religious standpoint, unfortunately, as it is in the world, it seems that you're coming from an exact opposite, which is you start with faith, you know, and you kind of get that confirmation bias going at the beginning and go from there. So just a quick comment. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thank you for the comment. And I'll read another comment here. Marty writes, in English, we admonish our children to be good. The French admonition for their children is be wise. And we're going to go to more, I don't know what it means between Americans and Gallic cultures, but we're going to bring another caller on. Cameron, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Yeah, thanks, Michael. My question is, does evil exist? And I say that in the context of the atrocities that we're seeing in the Middle East. And if there is human evil, does the rule of law, which I think a lot of countries enjoy, mitigate that or keep it under control? In other words, are we basically evil, but the laws keep that under control?
Well, I'm glad you brought up this question, Cameron, because evil is so often identified with theology. And, Krista Tippett, yet we use it in an everyday sense. People who have no belief use it.
Yes, it is. And I think it's a complicated word to start using because it can imply that we are calling people evil, and right? Or it can be that we're talking about the effects of actions on others, that it feels like evil. You know, I think we are so, this is kind of a different discussion, but we are so, so fortunate in this country to have the rule of law. I think that may be one way to talk about what the rule of law, when it is robust, does, that it actually curbs, it creates boundaries around the worst of which we're capable. But I think it's also, it's a fragile thing that we have to keep cultivating.
Well, when he uses a word like evil and applies it to the Middle East, it's easily applicable here in the West. You know, mm-hmm. All you have to do is take the morning newspaper and see what kinds of things are done by human beings to one another. And then get into that, your basic question. Is that also what it means to be human for those who do terrible deeds, as so many humans do?
Yes, that is part of us. The great theologian Reinhold Niebuhr said, you know, you only have to read today's newspaper to see that there's something to the idea of original sin.
or not so original. It gets kind of almost platitudinous or cliche. this sort of dastardly deeds just keep repeating themselves through civilization, I'm afraid. I want to bring another caller in, though, and we'll go to Santa Clara next. And welcome, Karen. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. The main manifestation of what I believe is the spiritual is pure consciousness. I've read much psychology and psychophysiology, and honestly, I've never found any explanation of what I experience as consciousness that satisfied me.
Well, it'll be an ongoing quest then for you. Who knows what you'll find? The mystery lies ahead. Thank you, Karen. Let me bring another caller on. Charles, we thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes. Am I the Charles?
Yeah, if you're Charles, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, especially Krista Tippett. You made a comment about fear manifesting as anger. And my point that I'd like to make is that I believe that anger is the natural reaction that humans have to the sense of injustice, to the sense of justice violated or injustice.
All right. Certainly an important point to make, and I thank you for it. Krista, let me just ask you, we'll try to take some more phone calls here, but with all the people you spoke with, and this is a question I often get and I kind of balk at it, you know, people say, who was your best interview? Who was your most interesting interview? There have been too many interviews, and probably that's true for you.
I have that same problem.
But when somebody says, if you could crystallize some of the greatest wisdom that came, because this is a lot in your book, mm-hmm. what do it off the top of the head, like Gladwell says, you know, what comes immediately to mind or who? In the way of the most wise remark.
I always feel like the greatest person I ever interviewed was the last person I interviewed because they're kind of with me. To the comment about spirituality being consciousness, you know, and I do write about this. So there's a whole chapter of my book about the body, and I actually find the spirituality that interests me is never merely spiritual. It's always embodied. And in fact, we're learning about our bodies that, you know, they carry memories. They carry trauma. They carry joy. So this kind of distinction that we've made across history and we've made in medicine and in philosophy as much as religion between body, mind, and spirit is very artificial. And so to your question, you know, there's a palpable quality of, I would say, the wisest people I've sat across from, which would include, you know, Desmond Tutu or Wangari Maathai or John Lewis. And it is a kind of holding together in their person, and it has its physical as well as character or spiritual power. Like, these are truly powerful people. You feel that. And at the very same time, there's a gentleness and a tenderness. And it's a very unfamiliar combination of qualities. It kind of shakes you. It's a little bit jarring. You walk away from them. The world is a bit shaken up. And it also raises interesting questions. It kind of unsettles the idea that we walk around with about, you know, what power is there for.
Is perhaps being human using power in relationships and using power in ways that enhance humanity and that enhance the self? I mean, you think about all of those power brokers and all of those who have abused power, particularly despots and tyrants and so forth. They contrast to people like those that you've mentioned and others who have a sense of balance about power or have a sense of wanting to do good with power.
Yeah, that's one way to think about it, yeah.
Yeah, there are lots of ways to that. A myriad number. In fact, you can find out many of them in your book. And again, we're talking to Krista Tippett, and her book is called Becoming Wise, An Inquiry into the Mystery and Art of Living. And again, she'll be speaking at the Jewish Community Center in San Francisco on the 19th of April at 7 o'clock p.m., so you can indeed meet her there. Listener writes, from a Christian perspective, doubt is an integral component of faith. I wonder whether some religious or some non-religious folks do not understand that. Krista, good to have you with us. Appreciate it. Thank you.
So terrific to be. Thank you so much for having me.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. Remind you, you always can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Tomorrow we're going to talk with Amy Lewis in the, with Amy Goodman in the first hour, and then in the second hour with Adam Hochschild about the Spanish America, the Americans who were fought in the Spanish War. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.